Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun, the podcast, with your host, Tom Wilson, and guests from every corner of, well, you know, places where Tom's been and asked to be on his show. Tom, life, showbiz, people, here's Tom.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back, or welcome for the first time to the Big Pop Fun podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson, your tall and svelte and limber host, bringing you the best in what is big since I am large, what is pop since I've been associated with it, and what is fun, which is debatable. Hey, welcome everybody. Thanks for dropping by. You know, if you've been here before, welcome back. If this is your first time, hey, listen in, snuggle up, and get ready for a magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we cuddle next to each other and click our horses and glide over tufts of new grass. New spring grass fed by the melting snow as we await the coming of spring. Or as I like to call it, rehearsing death. Since Seneca, the philosopher of what thousands of years ago, they called asthma rehearsing death, which seems pretty accurate to me. But as everything begins to bloom, as the flowers come up and the trees begin to blossom and come alive again, I begin to wheeze heavily and dream of a bunker deep under the earth with heavily filtered air and maybe some macaroni and cheese, one of those mini fridges. And hey, I also want the DVD set of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 25th anniversary concerts, because I saw that on TV a few days ago, and we've certainly been enjoying it around the Wilson World Ranch here. Man, Sting and Stevie Wonder together again for the first time. Look that up on YouTube, man. They do Higher Ground with Stevie Wonder's band. Sting's playing. Then they go into Roxanne with Stevie Wonder. Then they go back to Higher Ground. It's really, really, really good. And oddly enough, Stevie Wonder's band is full of very dedicated musicians who seem to have practiced a lot, because, man, that thing was rocking. Thanks for dropping by. As I told you before, it's brought to you by art. Please support artists. Support every – hey, if kids are singing near you at a school, go. So what? I know you don't have a kid at the school. It's children singing. It's human beings working towards something, working toward a bit of art. Do you have a community theater? Do you want to go downtown? See a play. Go to an art show and buy something. You know that poster you have up on the wall? Maybe you have Nastasia Kinski with the snake. Maybe you have an old Michael Jordan dunking poster from 1982 in the living room. Isn't it time to take them down and just buy something, not very expensive, but buy something simple from someone who made it and put it up on your wall, and people will say, well, what is that thing? And you'll say, well, you know, it used to be Michael Jordan dunking, but now I've decided to, you know, get into life and support people who make things and not, you know, just be a media-driven robot or – okay, all right, something. Let me do a commercial for my book if you haven't downloaded it, for Nook, for iPad, for Kindle. It's called The Masked Man by Tom Wilson. People have been liking it a lot, and I appreciate it very much. Been very gratified by the reaction to it. And so thanks for that. And if you haven't read it, please read it, The Masked Man by Tom Wilson, and tell me what you think. What else is going on before I introduce my guest? I went to an open mic. I don't do that very often anymore, but I went to an open mic with a friend last week, the Unurban Cafe in Los Angeles. Now, Los Angeles has every kind of coffee shop, every kind of performance space, every kind of venue, and I've performed at all of them. The Unurban Cafe. Now, you guys know this kind of coffee house that I'm talking about, with the, you know, with the dreadlocksy people and the tattooy people and the, you know, and the piercy people and the kind of that. Yeah, grunge roots. Hey, we don't ascribe to the rules of society, man. We make coffee in really authentic ways. you know, which, hey, that's fine. That's fine. But hey, this was in Santa Monica, California, and this place has been around a long time. So you want to talk proto, you know, a prehistoric grunge roots coffee open mic-y place? They were talking the Unurban Cafe on a Friday night. It was actually a lot of fun. You know, I wasn't surprised, but it was great. And I thank the Unurban Cafe because there, as I said, there are a lot of performance venues in Los Angeles, even open mics. And sometimes the open mics around here, the people there are very good and they've practiced a lot too. And they have their songs and everything. But I think the fancier schmancier the venue is, the less the other performers listen to each other, the less the audience is engaged in what's going on stages. It's weird. It's an inverse relationship to me, because I've been to fancy schmancy coffee houses here where you play some songs and everything, and it's that kind of total conversation. And this is the performers. This is the people sitting there with their guitar case, and they're going on in three people, and they're not. They're just making phone calls and whatever. So anyway, my point being, at the Unurban Cafe, it's a simple place. Well, very simple as I described it, and but the people actually listen to you. You can do a little bit more unusual things, more arcane songs, more. You'll definitely see more oddities. But isn't that an interesting thing? I don't know. I find it interesting. As the dinosaur of the open mic. I'm a dinosaur about many things, but I freely admit it. That's okay. It wasn't always the case. I was a techno guy for a while. My wife was a computer software engineer. She actually had a security clearance from the government that I'm not allowed to know the extent of her security clearance. And I still don't know anything that she really worked on when she was when she had that job. And I'm not even kidding. They call it an extensive background investigation by the government. I don't know who it was. Department of Defense, CIA. I don't know who. But some guy in a suit came to my apartment and interviewed me way back when for 3 hours. Interviewing me, like, what? Where did I live? Who were my roommates? Where did I go to school? Every aspect of my life, in order to check her out. And of course, that interview was over, and I immediately called her and said, "Well, sorry, honey, I blew it for you, but you know, good luck. Good luck with any other career path that you might choose." But she got this security clearance, and so she was very early computery person, and I was too. And we had early computer. We had a Mac. We had a Mac, then we had a Mac. We owned a Mac SE with a 20 megabyte hard drive, internal. Yeah, you'll never need more memory than that. It's 20 megabytes inside the computer. You can hold an entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Anyway, okay. Yeah, I'm laughing too because it was outmoded. I think halfway home. In the box, it was outmoded as we took it out to plug it in. But like so many people now, I've just been swept away by the technological tsunami of USB ports and everything else. And so I'm not that great at it. I'm still back there going, well, where's the floppy drive? You know, look, I went to the Fox lot the other day. You have to wait in line now in order to get onto a lot to audition for something. So I didn't have an audition that day. I was going to an ADR session, additional dialogue replacement. That's where you go and you watch the movie or the TV show or whatever you're doing, and you do, if the dialogue was a little messed up or it wasn't recorded properly, you record that line over again. You look at it on the movie screen and you say, "Detective Johnson, here are the files." And, you know, you do that a number of times so that you match the lips and everything. So I was doing that at the Fox lot, and I've been to that stage a million times. So I'm showing my identification to the security guy and said, "I have an ADR session at this stage on the lot." And he's giving me directions. And I said, "Well, I've been there." And he's telling me how to go, but it seems wrong. It seems like this is a different place. He was just telling me in this kind of circuitous route. So I say, it's the Fox lot. And I say, "Wait a minute. No, this is the stage down there where MASH is, right? Where MASH, they did MASH, right? No, near those MASH stages." Yeah, he looks at me for 4 seconds and just says, "What?" And I go, yeah, the MASH offices are, we're down there when they, and he's just says, I don't, what is that? Yeah, not the only, he didn't know that they had shot MASH on the Fox lot or its location. He didn't like know what it was as a thing. So, yes, yes, I was utterly humiliated and saying, well, that's the first time I've done that thing. You know, that thing where the guy goes, well, you know, Ginger Rogers was actually a way better. And you go, Ginger Rogers, Dad, knock it off. So now I think that kind of they just stopped shooting MASH on the Fox lot, though it happened probably 30 years ago. But look, it made a great impression on me because one of my first auditions in Los Angeles, I was on the Fox lot and I was walking trying to find it. And there was the cast of MASH. I mean, Alan Alda was, you know, out on the street there. And that was, wow, that's MASH. And I know, and I was young, and so that made an impression. So I just associate that part of the law. I'll stop talking. Okay, but you know who is a technological marvel? Okay, I don't know how he does it, computers, but he's on everything. He's got, you know, he's got the Tumblr and Facebook and Twitter, and he's got a podcast. He's got Jonah Radio. He's on the Nerdist podcast. We actually met on the Nerdist podcast with Chris Hardwick. If you haven't heard my interview, my episode of the Nerdist podcast, you might look it up. We had fun. We had fun that day. And Jonah, I met Jonah there. And Jonah just seems like he's everywhere and connected to everything. He runs a show called The Meltdown Show in Los Angeles at Meltdown Comics on Sunset Boulevard, which is a show in the back of a comic book store, which has become the hippest, flippinest show in Los Angeles. It's just a fantastic show, and Jonah hosts it with another friend, Komal Nanjiani, from Franklin and Bash. Jonah seems to be everywhere, and I find him fascinating, and it was really neat to meet him. He's always been nice to me, and I thought, you know, he is on the Nerdist, he's everywhere, but I just wanted to talk to him on my podcast. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Jonah Ray.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Jonah Ray's here. I think we're going. So yes. This is good.
Yes.
Welcome. So far, if the equipment works.
I think so. Is it recording?
It is recording. The numbers are moving and the little lines.
That's how
technological I get. The little lines are going and I see that the number's going 16, 17.
The blinkies are going. Yeah. We can talk now.
When the blinkies are going. I was just mentioning how very busy you are, and thanks very much for coming onto my podcast since you are one of the – you know, maybe you're not the king of the Nerdist Empire.
No.
You are a prince.
I'd like to think that I am the court jester.
You are the court jester of the Nerdist Empire.
Because it makes me seem tertiary, and it also makes me seem like the funniest one.
Yeah, exactly. And the first time tertiary has been thrown into one of my conversations with people within the first 20 seconds, for which I congratulate you.
Oh, when I start telling you about every TV show I've ever worked on, I'll use tertiary quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah, because it's always the end of the dial.
Yeah.
So we're
both talking about just, you know, surviving in show business and the things we like to do as opposed to the things that we have to do for money.
Yes.
In order to pay for this fabulous house that you have.
This rental. This East Side LA rental.
Undisclosed location.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles,
my little punk rock bungalow in the back.
It's very nice.
Yeah.
Now, did you grow up near here? Did you grow up in Los Angeles?
No, I grew up on Oahu. In the islands of Hawaii.
Haole from Oahu?
Yes, a Haole. My family's not necessarily Haole. My dad's
They're Hawaiian.
My dad's Portuguese, which Portuguese is like one of the first wave of immigrants to work on the plantation. So
in Hawaii.
Yeah. So the culture of Hawaii is very much based off of not necessarily just Hawaiians, but like a big part of the culture is just this melting pot, more so than any other place I've ever been. Where it's like, you know, the culture there is made up of Hawaiian, Portuguese, Japanese, Filipino, Chinese, you know, Anglo.
Not to take us off on a wild tangent, but I was fascinated by the Richard Dana book, 2 years before the mast, about sailing around the world in the 1700s on a ship.
Yeah.
And in Southern California, the number of Hawaiians, which they called Sandwich Islanders.
Yes.
Who lived on the beaches of Southern California in these huts, and he described them and Richard Dana, as a sailor, just a working sailor on a ship, loved
the Sandwich Islanders, because they were wonderful, sweet, warm people, helpful, great workers, and all it was great.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't give them a blanket. You wipe them out.
I don't think Richard Dead was involved in the giving of blankets to Sandwich Islanders at the time.
I'm very proud of where I'm from. I very much feel like I am like I'm not Hawaiian by blood, but you know, I grew up in Hawaii. My family is very, you know, Portuguese, which is a very big part of Hawaii. I very much identify every time I meet somebody from Hawaii. We have a lot to talk about, and that's just the same case with like a lot of places. But you know, you hear a lot of people talking where they say, oh, you're from Chicago too? And they'll be, well, I'm from Naperville. Oh, well, I'm from, like, to me, that's not the same. They're from like a landmass somewhere else. Like, if you took that area and carved it out of the earth and put it in the middle of the ocean, I'd, you know, that's like, you have to be connected with those people because there's no other way around
it. So you're saying you're better than us?
I'm not better, but like, you know, it's
you're
funny.
Saying you're different, but in a better way.
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people like, you know, because I, you know, it comes up a lot where you're from, and, you know, because where you're from really is a big part of who you are as an adult. And so on the Nerdist podcast, in conversation, I will bring up that I'm from Hawaii. And a lot of internet commenters like to say, oh, we get it. You're from Hawaii. And then my response to them is always, well, tell me what boring place you're from. And you know, they'll be like, Connecticut. I go, well, not as interesting as Hawaii. And that sounds like a mean thing to say, but like, it's like,
I find Connecticut fascinating.
Do you? Yes.
I do.
Can you tell the difference?
Really from Pennsylvania, which is, I mean, a place that, I mean, we all identify with our place.
Yeah.
And as I've talked about on my podcast, I'm from Philadelphia, so we just have our thing.
Yeah.
And you're going to just gravitate toward your thing.
Yeah, you're going to talk about like, well, in Philly or growing up in Philly, I mean, like, think about like the early career of Will Smith.
Right.
It was all about where he was from.
Exactly.
And, you know, just because of the case that where I'm from is a really interesting place to most people. To me, it's just what I know. But to most people, when I say, oh, when I grow up in Hawaii, people go, oh, we get it. Because to them, they're projecting that I'm trying to say that it's more of a special place than any other place.
No, you're just saying that you're from this place and those are your experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that was the thing about like, even like when I started doing comedy, everyone's like, why don't you talk about being from Hawaii? I say, because it's so much more foreign than people understand. Like, you know,
of course, it's like me going to the Howley thing because we all have. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia. Everyone has some Rocky joke or something.
Yeah.
Well, let's say whenever there's a Philadelphia sports team, the camera has to go to the cheesesteaks grilling on the grill with the onions and everything.
Exactly.
And I'm sitting there saying, you know, it's far more than sandwiches. It was the first capital of the United States and has the first fire department, library, and many, many things. The University of Pennsylvania. Yeah.
I gave Philadelphia one thing that it's probably the littering capital of the world. I've never been to another city where people blatantly litter the streets of their fair city.
Really? You think so?
Every time I've been there, I've like seen people just like I saw this one guy eating a sandwich. It wasn't a cheesesteak sandwich, so it's not, you know, I'm not saying that. But he was eating a sandwich and then he crumples up the paper when he's done and just throws it on the ground, finishes his soda, throws it on the ground. This man was leaning against a trash can.
Right, right.
He could have, by just dropping the stuff, he would have not littered. But he made it a point to just throw it on the street. And like,
well, see, in Philadelphia, we care about people. It's person to person. We don't care about the street like you Hawaiians.
In Hawaii.
We're all like, oh, look at our clean streets. And then, but there's a lot of hatred in there.
There's it's the most, everyone asks me, like, what's the thing about Hawaii? It's like, it's the most racist place you'll ever go in your life.
I was just kidding.
Yeah.
No,
it's
kidding.
I got beat up for being a white guy, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, my last name is Rodriguez, which is
Rodriguez. Is like a Portuguese.
Yes, the Portuguese version. Like, you know, I have a friend named Jason Gomes.
Yeah, sure.
And Lopes and all that stuff. But you know, I sometimes would have to get out of fights by saying like, "Look at my brother. That's my brother." Like, you know, my brother is a dark guy that looks Portuguese, and be like, "I'm Adam Rodriguez's brother." They go, "Oh, okay." You know, then I'm okay because I'm, you know, half brown.
Yeah. What were you? Did you perform in Hawaii when you were growing up and stuff?
I was in bands. I was in punk bands.
And really?
Very, very, very aggressive,
punky thing. Really? Yeah. When did that start? I mean, when you're a punk kid like that, and I guess I wasn't a punk kid.
It started a little after.
In 1975, I went to a John Denver concert.
Yeah.
Just so understand
it. It didn't get going, though, until like a few years after that.
Oh, yeah. I certainly remember all the Sex Pistols and that stuff when I was in college at the time. So, we all listened to that stuff and everything. But when you're – like, how old were you – when you heard something and thought, yeah, that's really cool?
Well, what it was, you know, I think it was pretty much It was Nirvana came out. Uh-huh. Nirvana came out, and it was aggressive, and it was like, you know, like really crazy.
Yeah.
And you know, then you if you become a fan of a band, you kind of research them, and then you know, in interviews they say, oh well, we liked, you know, Black Flag, we liked you know, Sex Pistols or Melvins and stuff like that, and then you start researching those bands, and uh-huh. then like you go, oh, it's, and because no one really knows about it, it's a kind of a fun feeling, you know, it's like I know this thing that Kurt Cobain knows about, and I know about it, but all these people don't know about it. And it's kind of exciting as you explore. It's, you know, it's kind of like it's like baseball. There's a history to it, and like it kind of it's like, you know, a web that just kind of creeps around, and you just start finding how all these different bands are connected and where they come from and who they were inspired by. Mm-hmm. You know, and then you go, oh, well, then before that it was like, you know, before the Ramones and Sex Pistols, there was Iggy and the Stooges, and you kind of keep on, and then MC5, sure. and you kind of, it's really fun. It's the same reason I like comedy so much.
So that kind of punk rage thing, was that something you think that was that inside of you, and it harmonized with something that was inside of you from when you were a kid, or were you, you know, pretty much a regular kid there in Hawaii and it opened up something new?
Well,
that you followed. Does my question make sense?
Yeah. I'm going to have to say that it awoke something. I mean, I'm growing up in this place that I shouldn't belong. I get called Howley. I get guys telling me to get off their land, get off their island.
Right.
You know, go home. Go home, Howley. Go to mainland, Howley. You know, yeah, I get, yeah. You know, this is, but I kind of belong because my dad's family is from here. His grandparents are from there. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been there for, you know, a long, long time. But yet I'm being told that I don't belong, and I'm, you know, I'm pale skin, and I start getting really fat. Like I became this fat kid out of nowhere, and it just, you know, not belonging and kind of getting angry and not really having anyone to, you know, and just this aggressive music really kind of, you know, spoke to me.
Ah, so it was kind of the quiet kid who's taken in a lot. Who's, I mean, there's been a lot of input.
Yeah.
That you haven't really answered.
Yeah,
except for eating Twinkies.
Yeah, right?
Just input, negative input, negative input, negative input,
yeah.
negative input. You hear the Black Flag album and go, oh.
Yeah, oh, shoot.
Guys are just up there like screaming and stuff and
yeah.
doing something
just
that
pounding,
I would like
yeah.
to do.
Yeah, and it really resonated with me, and it was just, I thought it was so cool, and it was you know, and when you're coming into adolescence, you become reactionary towards the norm, and the norm in Hawaii is to, you know, be like kind of a pot smoker, relax, brah, just chill on the beach, brah, let's go eat, you know, it's like it's Bob Marley, it's reggae, it's very relaxed, laid back, and when you're a kid, you need to rebel. And so for me to rebel was to listen to like the opposite of this music and to act the opposite of these people and to not do drugs and to not, like, you know, drink mm-hmm. and to not, you know, do what everybody else is doing. You know, my family and all these other adults, they're all like potheads. This is just the culture of Hawaii. My reaction was to be straight edge and to not do any of that stuff. And it, you know, it coincided when you find out about this band Minor Threat, and they're talking about, like, you know, like we don't drink and we don't smoke and we're still like crazy and we're awesome.
Yeah.
And you're like, you can still be cool.
Yeah.
You can still be cool and be like these guys.
That was that was my thing when I was later in high school, when I found, you know, expression on stage and,
yep.
and improvisation and music and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. The reaction was like from the quote unquote normal kids, like, what are you on?
Yeah.
Or what are you smoking? Or what's wrong with you? Or whatever. And I'm like, you know, you can actually do this completely straight, completely
yeah.
normally.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and be a lunatic.
Yeah, you guys must. Yeah, we get that all the time because we go crazy on stage with our bands. It's like,
right.
what are you guys on? It's like nothing.
Nothing.
You know?
Oxygen.
Yeah, just oxygen and adrenaline and artistic output.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I wanted to act when I was a kid. We'd do sketches. I was in a couple plays, but I don't think I did the right thing when I was in those plays.
What do you mean the right thing?
I don't think I went for the right, you know, these were high school things, and yeah. I didn't like any of the people that were doing them. And I think I was too much, you know, still I had that reactionary spirit, and I think I was too
Kind of fighting the man a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, you know, and then, like, you know, I didn't get the cheer, you know, when these people are just like straight up cheery, like I need to see a little bit of darkness in somebody.
To trust them?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why it took me a long time to kind of warm up to a mutual friend of ours, Pete Holmes,
uh-huh.
where it's like, you know, it's this cheery, happy guy.
Right.
And then one time, like, he was just kind of like had this tired moment and he said something. And I was like, oh, you're a real person. You know, you have the layers of that make a person a human.
But isn't that cheery guy? I mean, that's just another defense mechanism, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, it's just another wall.
But that's scary, you know? That's like I need someone that's going to be like realistic, you know, in their conversations. And, you know, because sometimes when you're with your friends, you don't want someone to go, it's going to be all right. Everything's going to be. You just want someone else to go, yeah, man, it really sucks. Right. Yeah. You know, sometimes you need that.
Yeah.
Because you need to commiserate.
What was your first band?
My first band was always with my friend Donald. My friend Donald is the guy that kind of helped get me into punk rock and stuff like that. And we were just me and him. He was on guitar or a distorted bass, depending on what was working at the time.
Right.
I was playing drums, and we would just like, you know, just play. Nothing ever. We never. And then all of a sudden we found out that there was like, you know, bands in Hawaii that just like playing these all ages clubs or these cafeterias at schools after mm-hmm. hours. And we went to them and we're like, oh my, yeah, that blew my world.
Like there's just a way to get on in front of people.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. You had no idea. Cause you're thinking just like, oh, we're going to have to get really good and then maybe move to the mainland and get signed. And then we'll be opening up for Metallica or something like that, you know? But then when I saw that there was actually punk rock stuff happening on our island, you know, that was crazy. That like we needed to get on those shows. We needed to get on stage, and we needed to be in front of people. And you know, like we just starting bands, meeting guys, starting bands with them.
Sure.
Just getting out and getting in front of people.
Now, when you're a young guy and you're getting into punk and you're going up on stage. What are the songs about? Where are the songs coming from?
So my first like band, like real band, where we like you know actually made good songs and actually ended up playing out was called the Year Outs. The first song we made was about the movie Home Alone. It was just because it was on
uh-huh.
and it was just
write what you know.
Yeah. Write what you know. And yeah. Then, you know, there was like, we're all just gross teenage guys. And so we're making like, you know, really gross songs, like making like, you know, never like about us doing gross stuff. It was always like calling out creeps that we knew,
sure.
You know, it's like, this guy's gross. Cause he talked about smelling girls' hair before, you know, so it has a song about that.
Uh-huh.
You know, my friend made wrote a song about my dad. It's called, it was originally called Jonah's Dad Smoke My Pot. It was a story based on like where, my dad stole one of my brother's friend's sacks of weed.
Uh-huh.
And then like just took it for his own use.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you can't say that. So they changed it to Joe's dad. I'm sure no one noticed. Yeah, you know, like you
so
know,
everything
werewolves,
was a slice
zombies,
of your life. Yeah,
yeah,
right. Everything was just where you were right then.
Yeah,
and just writing.
Yeah. Then the band after that, like the guys were, you know, really into politics, and so it all became about, you know, vegetarianism and you know,
punk songs about vegetarianism.
Yeah, and war. These were more hardcore, more like socially conscious. You know,
uh-huh.
This is one of the singer was actually a guy. That's another thing about the town I grew up in. Right next to it was a huge Marine base, Kaneohe Marine Base, mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of that, like kind of like, you know, there's a lot of, I had to deal with a lot of good old boys too.
Right.
A lot of
right.
You know, just kind of I don't want to. I like a lot of hicks, a lot of redneck guys, mm-hmm. And that was the craziest thing. Like, I didn't even feel like akin to white guys I knew because they're all just these grunts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, walking down a street, hearing a truck pull up, you don't know if it's going to be a bunch of like local guys or a bunch of you know, Marines,
yeah.
Just because they're bored.
So you really did grow up in a cultural kaleidoscope.
Yeah,
I mean, of different
yeah.
kind of cultures from everywhere.
Yeah, it's pretty gnarly.
Is there you know, did you go to school back here or anywhere, or what? Like when do you decide to get on the plane and just say, Dad, Mom, I'm going.
Well, it was tough. I remember, like, you know, you just have that stigma that everyone grows up with, like it's like LA sucks.
Right.
You're just supposed to say that LA sucks,
yeah.
You know, and it doesn't. I think it's one of the best cities in the world. I haven't been in many countries, but in the country, I think it's like one of my favorites.
Uh-huh.
And it's because you have to, it's a city that makes you work to find out how awesome it is. Like a good lover, you know, mm. Like it's like, you know, with LA, you have to know how to treat it.
Sounds like a good punk song.
Yeah. but I didn't want to go. And then I started drinking, like I was straight edge up until after high school. After high school, I tried drinking and it was like, Hawaii was a wholly, totally different place for me. And I just was still in bands and I didn't go to college. I was like, I'm going to take a year off.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like was in bands and I worked at record stores and I rode my bike everywhere. It was, It's great. Like, I had lost a bunch of weight. I had lost a ton of weight from, like, being a fat kid in high school. And girls were paying attention to me.
Because punk, and, sure, you're in bands and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, it was really cool. And then I was like, because of that year of being in a band that people kind of liked for finally, and for losing that weight and just kind of being on my own, I got more confidence than I ever had in my entire life. You know, just when you're a fat kid growing up, you're just, you know, you know, you're a big guy, you slouch, you know, you kind of, you hide your size. You know, I did that a lot. Like still like wearing plaid. I started wearing plaid when I started getting big because it was a way to just kind of distract from, you know, my man boobs and my belly. Uh-huh. You know, just like all these like things, you know, right when I could grow sideburns, I grew them out because they're kind of slimming, you know, all these things. But once I lost all this weight and it was kind of doing things and being my own person and being known as kind of a funny guy, like I got all this confidence to move to LA to finally do what I've always wanted to do, which was comedy.
Which was comedy.
Yeah.
So you didn't come here as a punk rocker.
You were doing
music in Hawaii, but you're like, I'm going to LA to do comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was
interesting.
That was the whole idea. And then I moved here and I got completely scared and then went to where my safe place was, which was like being with bands, hanging out with bands, trying to play in bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting so depressed. I was very, very depressed that time.
LA wasn't working out. How old were you when you got here?
19. I just turned 19. And I was lonely. I was scared. Sure. It was just like really scary, you know.
What were you trying to do? You were getting up on stage doing stand up?
Not yet. I was too scared to even try.
Oh.
I was too like, I was like, this place is huge. And like I just gravitated towards what I knew and I just talked, and you know, a few months after being out here, I went and did one of those audition classes at Groundlings.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this whole idea in my head that's gonna be people like me, former punks that, you know, are just like alternative types or indie rock types,
right.
You know. That wanted to do acting and comedy, and I always figured I never thought of myself as a stand-up guy. I thought of myself as like like a Chris Farley or you know
your sketches,
yeah, that sketches. Kind of you know that's all I ever wanted to do, and that's all I did like in school. You know,
yeah.
Every time in school they would give you a thing where it's like, and then you guys got to make a fake commercial. I was the kid that always had the best, funniest one, which is the most confident thing I'll ever say about my comedy. But and so I go to this Groundlings thing, and I know this is how it has to be, and I know it's how it is, and it's for that for a reason. But I wasn't expecting it. I didn't know what to expect, which is like someone telling you you're not funny, stop trying to be funny, and I wasn't ready to hear that yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what you in improv you shouldn't try to be funny. You let it be funny,
right?
And I wasn't ready for that,
yeah.
And it bummed me out. The person says, "Stop being funny. You're not funny." And I took it the completely wrong way.
Well, as a kid would. You take it to the extreme.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Because you said that one thing that today I was wrong my entire life.
Yeah,
has been
exactly.
A bad trajectory.
It made me
convinced. I shouldn't have come here.
Yeah, it was real bad. And then I was like, maybe this isn't what I want. And then I just did nothing for a year of living out here. Hung out bands, lived
how'd
in San Pedro.
That? I mean, how did you make money?
No, I worked at a record store.
Oh, okay.
You know, and that's not a progressive, job.
Yeah.
It's just, you're just there.
Right. You're just there talking bands and selling some stuff.
Yeah. And that's the thing about working at a record store. It feels like something's always going on because there's always stuff coming
band,
in. There's
right.
always a new band to talk about.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of guys get stuck doing that kind of stuff because it's always, you know, it's always something new. It feels like stuff is happening. You're reading. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this band that we liked is blowing up. You know, you feel like you're a part of it. And I just, so I worked there. I worked at a Borders bookstore. And then I was just getting depressed nonstop. And I never knew depression really before. I knew being bummed out as a fat kid that couldn't get girls, but I didn't know like
one of those long ones that's not really improving.
Yeah, yeah, like it's like, and I didn't even really realize until one of my friends said like, Jonah's a sad drunk. And I go, what? I'm a good time, happy guy. What are you talking about, sad drunk? And I kind of like realized, I was like, oh, yeah, I am always kind of bummed out. I'm always, we get to that point, you're waiting for it to get dark to just kind of drink and hang out. And because when you're doing that, it's like drinking and hanging out with your friends is the most now thing you could really do as a young person. It's the most immediate fun thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I still look forward to it. I still really like getting drinks with friends. I still think it's a very great way to bring the past, present, and future all into one moment and to really, talk crap and stuff. But I realized I was getting so depressed because I wasn't doing anything. You know, as an artist type where you you're like, oh, I haven't created anything in a while. And like I haven't been in bands for like a, you know, like almost a year at that point. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I haven't been making anything. My whole like youth growing up to this, I was making videos, making like, you know, music and bands, like doing funny poems after my, you know, my bands would play and stuff like that. And like I realized I'd just been nothing, no artistic output. And if you're an artistic type, you need that.
Man, that's a prescription for depression.
Yeah.
The artistic creative type to start doing nothing.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
just kind of killing time and say, boy, why am I always so bummed out all the time? You're just not doing anything.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Making something.
Yeah. And I mean, even like, you know, sometimes it can be something as – and it because you can get to a place in your head too, like us, like, you know, where we're at now is like, you know, we tend to just keep on – we're doing stuff all the time. But there could be sometimes like a week that goes by and you're like – I haven't really said anything funny. I haven't had a funny tweet. I haven't gone on stage. I haven't progressed in anything. And sometimes, like, all that you need to fix that is, like, you can just maybe even pick up a guitar and, like, make a quick little song to yourself.
Absolutely.
And you feel a lot better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or write a little dumb joke or do something.
Something. Because, some yeah. outward, out, you know, some output.
Yes. It's easy to forget. Just the daily upkeep of the fun factory.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
You know,
yeah.
that the fun factory has to keep producing
yeah.
things.
Or it'll rust out.
It'll rust out, yeah. and you just get bummed out.
Yeah.
And then you end up just staring out the window.
And you don't. And that's the craziest thing about like depression in that way is that you forget. You forget that that's what it's for, what mm-hmm. happens. You're like, oh, am I bummed out? Well, I'm just going to take a nap.
Right.
Why am I bummed out? And then you forget. Then you forget until the moment you do something. You're like, oh, that's I got to remember that next time.
Yeah,
I got to remember that. Just doing stuff makes me feel better.
Yep.
And so I was getting so depressed that I was at the record store, and my boss there was also always had ideas of doing stand up, and I was like, you know, I'm gonna go start looking at open mics, and I just went to go look at them. I went to open mics, you know, in the LA Weekly, started seeing how they worked, seeing the dynamics, seeing how people do it. You know, I would always go to an open mic once or twice before ever signing up to do it. And finally, the first time I got up was at the Haha Cafe on Lancashire.
Yeah, over in the valley.
Yeah, and it was the worst slash greatest moment of my life. You mm-hmm. know, because it was like it didn't go that well, but it was the feeling of just like this is what I want. This is what I need. That's the thing. It's more about
was it, you know, what did you need? That was like the audience was they were attentive enough.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Just enough.
Yeah,
and you kind of the feeling under the spotlight and just that microphone. Or?
Yeah, you're just there and there's people paying attention to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got their heads in their notebooks because they're about to go on too.
Right.
But it's just that like it's like I am here now doing this.
Right.
And it was so exhilarating. And you know, I got some laughs and those were enough.
Sure.
Yeah. And then I just like, I was like, what's the next open mic? What's on Tuesday nights? And then that was the dumbest thing. That's such a nerdy thing. It's like, I started on a Monday. I started on a weekday.
Oh,
like,
right.
It's like, this is the start of the week. I got to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Tuesday, I went to the Bruco, the Westwood Bruco in Westwood Village. And that was the one that like, I went up and some other guys saw me and they came up and started talking to me afterwards. And it was like being in a band again
mm-hmm.
where I was, you know. Like, you know, you play at a show and the other bands that you like come up to you and go, hey, that was a good set.
You're in the in group. You're
yeah.
just, hey, you're one of us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now, like, it's like all of a sudden I was like, oh, this feels so good. You know, the social aspect, the just sure. talking about comedy with people. Because, you know, all I ever did and wanted to do was talk about comedy. But to the normal person, that gets real old real fast for them.
But in order to hang out with friends just talking about comedy, you actually, unfortunately, have to go do it for a while.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
And then you get to the fun part, which is just hanging out talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and there's, you know, it's so funny, too, because the, you know, you think about when you first start and then, like, you're talking to a guy that's, like, been on the road. And like it's like he's like you're like yeah you know when you have a bad set and they go you don't know anything about a bad set
right.
you shut up kid and
right
then,
exactly
and then like you know when you like you get like you go do the road you're like oh and then you start talking to a guy that's like been on TV and he's like you don't know the stress yeah there's always and that was always the, that was the thing about it's almost kind of a bad thing to happen too with comedy. I'm not sure if you ever felt this where you know it when you start you're like it's like okay I want to do good at that open mic and then you do good at that open mic and you're like it still doesn't feel real. You know, once I get on a book show, once I get on like someone's book show at a coffee shop, that's when it'll feel real. Or when I get brought up to stage. You came up in the clubs. which is a, like a bit different, I think. But
well, I was even sometime before the clubs. Some clubs were open, like one per city.
Yeah,
but also yeah, I did like the you know, folk rooms and coffee houses and all kinds of stuff. But yes, clubs were opening. This was way before the comedy boom of the mid to late 80s.
Yeah. What year did you start again?
1979.
That's right.
I'm cutting this out of the podcast. it's not going to be on.
Really?
There. Yeah. Well, now when you know guys come up to me and they go, "Boy, that was when did you start? How long have you been doing stand up?" I just, you know, a long time. Long time. Yeah, but how long? Yeah, long, yeah. Really long. Time.
What was the feeling? Because I was listening to the episode you did recently with DC Pearson,
uh-huh.
who's a great guy. And it's like, you know, you started doing commercials like pretty fast, right? After being out here? Or?
I was, as I've told people here, I was the bouncer at the Comedy Store because I was big. So they just said, "Hey, if you want, it's a good way to get spots."
Yeah.
If somebody doesn't show up, you'll get the spot.
You're there.
So I was doing that, and yeah, I got, you know, the Kentucky Fried Chicken commercial where I introduced biscuits and gum commercials and various commercials like that. I introduced biscuits.
I know, it's just such a funny thing. It's like you were there for biscuits are huge at Kentucky Fried Chicken.
They've been there ever since.
Yes.
Ever since my commercial. They've never even considered. You know, I think, let's get together. I'm not sure the biscuits are working out.
Yeah.
No.
No.
They
should bring you back for like the 30th anniversary of their biscuits.
Right. I did like Swiss Miss Hot Chocolate.
Yeah.
I did every kind of all-American young guy.
Yeah.
With a baby or something. The young guy with a baby or the young construction worker under the wing of the older guy.
Yeah.
Hey, kid, watch your head. Okay. Okay. You know.
Was stand-up like a thing you wanted to do, or was it also like, it's like, I'll do stand-up and that'll help me also with my acting?
At that time, before the comedy boom happened, it seemed smart to always work on acting, which I had done. Unlike a lot of people that I knew, unlike a lot of comics that I knew, I started as an actor. A couple of my friends did stand-up. I looked down my nose at stand-up.
Yeah.
You know, like, but it seemed like, all right, well, they, you know, it's, they're kind of having fun. The real thing for me was I was kind of singing songs and going to coffee houses. They made money. Not a lot of money, but they made like $10.
Yeah.
And a cheeseburger at comedy clubs. So I was like, you mean if I write something funny, you get $10 in food?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I could do that.
See, that's like I think about that so much because when I started, which, you know, it was 10 years ago, and it was, you know, it's at the post alternative kind of thing. So to say that you wanted to do comedy and also use that as a way to get into acting was just like that was the worst thing you could say.
Of course.
And it's taken me years to tell people that, like, yeah, I've always also really wanted to act. And, like, it's like, because, like, I feel it's like, well, is that why you're doing it? No, I love stand-up.
But, Jonah, trust me, and I don't mean to diss comics personally on the podcast, but the thing with comedians is there's a lot of judgment against guys coming in to the fraternity and girls coming to the fraternity. And if you say, you just have to say exactly the right thing.
Yeah.
You have to toe the line of the zeitgeist or you will be an outcast. And I've pretty much been an outcast since day one.
And now, do you think that's a lot of you or do you think that's a lot of what you got right out in the beginning?
Because I got a lot right out of the beginning.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning.
And you just held it.
Absolutely. You know, I played the tuba on stage, Jonah. You know, I played the tuba. Yeah. I had a guitar because I thought, well, I write funny songs and stuff. I'll do whatever I think is funny. I'll just do it.
So they thought you were kind of a gimmick guy.
Yeah. So they're like, no, here's what you do. You hold the microphone. You stand in front of a brick wall and you observe things. You observe things. That's
everyone's
what you do.
The same.
Have you ever noticed about asparagus?
Yeah.
That's weird, huh? I mean, whoever thought of eating a spear? You know, that stuff bored me to tears.
Yeah.
I just didn't find it interesting.
Yeah.
So I did anything I wanted to do, in a sense, looking back on it, in my own way. I don't mean to over-romanticize it, but it was... in a way, a punk expression
creativity. You were doing your own
thing. I was doing whatever I felt like on stage.
Yes.
And no one was going to tell me, do this, don't do that. You have to fit into this.
Yeah.
I'm doing this thing. Everyone else can do whatever they want. It's America. There are stages. It's called an open mic.
Yeah.
Open.
Yeah.
You could, you know, and back and way back in olden comedy times, there were guys who still were doing almost vaudevillian-like acts. There was a guy who just brought up a dinner onto the stage and ate the whole thing, like the napkin and the plate and stuff, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, I remember coming to L.A., well, as I've told on the podcast before, but Michael Richards and Ed Begley Jr. played silent movie music over the sound system and just sawed up a dining room table. With like saws, like that was their act.
Yeah,
and it was very, it was of course incredibly esoteric, not particularly funny, except to comedians. They were just doing something, you know, on purpose. They were just being, we're just sawing up a dining room table to music tonight. That's what we're doing. So it seemed like it was more of an open. Of an open thing, but
yeah.
But very, very early on, it was no. You have to do this thing.
Yeah.
You have to wear a shiny jacket and push the sleeves up around your elbows, and do and do kind of an impression of early Jerry Seinfeld or the guys who were getting the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
So I'm off my point, but my point being, I guess it was. A lot of expression, and I think anyone who's doing that in any way is just going to get slammed.
Yeah, and I did, and they were just like, you're not a part. Like, did you make friends like pretty fast? Like, because you're a very gregarious guy.
I'm a gregarious person, so yeah. I guess I made friends, but my friends always had. Well, usually or very early on, they had something to comment about what I was doing.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so like, sort of backhanded compliments.
So it's kind of like, it's like, oh, this is Tommy's really nice act is
right. Mm. Also, if I may be so bold, I started getting good pretty fast.
Yeah, and was it your theater background?
Yes.
Yeah.
It absolutely was my theater background because I was very bad. When I was just getting on stage and going crazy. Then I sort of. Because I had studied theater and everything, I kind of like, well, it's a show. It's like a play.
Ah.
It's like a 7-minute play.
Yeah.
And I'm not Tom. I'm a character called Tom tonight in my 7-minute play that I'm going to do.
And that was the thing that helped
That was
you.
The thing, the performance aspect of it, not necessarily the material or choosing between materials. It was the performance of it suddenly sold a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, because there was just this stuff. Dedication behind it as opposed to you just going, I'm going to say these jokes.
After that, I don't think I ever gave the audience the opportunity to not like something again.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I really, from that point on, look at it as sort of a psychological experiment. And I really do believe that if you step on stage and you just are just exuding, I am the king of this entire room, the audience has an amazing capacity for saying, you are the king of this entire room.
Yeah, exactly.
And just you're just saying, look, this is stuff that I came up with and I think it's good.
Yeah. I was told, Dana Gould told me when I was going to do Conan, he says, you remember when the curtains open up and you walk out to your mark, they may say your name, but in your head you hear, ladies and gentlemen, George Carlin.
Right.
And like, and then like that, just having that in my head of just like, you know, it's like, I'm the guy. And it always helps me. Like now I think of that a lot when I like, you know, when I go on stage, I'm just like, in my, they're seeing me and they're hearing my name, but like when I'm walking out, I'm George Carlin and I'm ready to do business.
Yes, I hate Gallagher. I don't hate him. Look, Jonah, I don't know what you're. I'm a Christian person. I'm not allowed to hate people.
Yes,
so let's say I dislike Gallagher because we've had some run-ins in the past. However, very early on when I was in LA, Gallagher was around a lot of people waxing poetic about comedy. He did say, hey, guys, it's 90% confidence. It's just getting out there and just owning the place. And I think he's right.
Yeah.
He's wrong about everything other thing. Everything else.
Well, you know, he goes to show that, yeah, he had so much confidence to think that people were going to go crazy for him smashing a watermelon. And people did.
Yes.
And so.
Yes, they did. And, you know, giving Gallagher some credit, and we don't get along, but. Before he got to watermelon smashing, he had at least, I think, 4 Tonight shows that the crowd went crazy.
Oh, really?
Over, where he had to stop and try to get people to calm down he had more jokes to do. It was at that time, it went really very, very well. And then he did Showtime specials where it's like an hour and I need another hour and then smashing, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
give
yeah.
me a hammer
props
and
stuff like
stuff,
that.
Right.
No, because I remember seeing some early stuff of his and it's like, you know, he's a comic.
Right.
The guy, yeah. But, you know, maybe it just, you know, he saw the thing that really connected with people.
Right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess I don't want to belabor the point, but confidence has a lot to do with it. And showing that kind of confidence when you're a young person is – they're going to take out Gallagher's sledgehammer on you.
Yeah.
Because you're daring to say, I think I'm better than all these guys.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stick my neck out and I'm going to do better shows and I'm ready to do another gig that's better than this gig.
Yeah. I never had that. I still to this day, like, I have no confidence with anything I do.
Do you really not?
No, I don't. And it's weird to say that because as I, you know, no one forced me to put out, like, you know, I put out a couple records. Like, no one forced me to do that. No one's forcing me to continue to go on stage or, you know, do gigs. But I still, like, I don't know where it came from or what it is about. I don't have, like, you know, I don't feel that I'm very good. I don't feel like, that I'm very, like, I think I'm a funny guy, but I don't think I'm a good stand-up. I'm funnier than my material. You know, I don't have a lot of confidence when it comes to that thing, which is a bad thing to say, especially in a public forum like this.
Honestly, I agree with you towards myself. I've never thought I think I was better than everybody. Yeah. I just thought, well, I mean, if you can do it, get up here.
Yeah.
You know, get up here and do it. But for right now,
yeah.
I'm the one who put the work in and I have the microphone and I'm on stage.
Yeah.
It's pretty democratic. If you're funnier than me and sell tickets and stuff, they're going to fire me and hire you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So it's, you know, Ethel Merman, the great, you know, a musical theater lady. Everyone says, are you nervous on stage? She said, look, if anybody else here could, you know, could do it, they'd be up here doing it. So whatever.
Yeah.
Think you can sing better? Get up here.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where that comes from, but like, it's just, it's still a thing that like every once in a while it comes up where it's, you know, like when I saw the other people that got the half hours for Comedy Central,
right.
When I saw the list and I saw my name on it, it was kind of like, not like I saw my, not like they put up grades and I saw my name on the page, but, when I found out who else got it and who didn't get it, like I felt like I had like survivor's guilt. I was like, well, how dare they not give it to, you know, Jim Hamilton or, you know, John Roy or anything. You know, like, it's like, how, like, I was so confused. That was my initial reaction. Before getting excited about getting a half hour, my first thought was that, like, I don't deserve it. These guys do. And that's a constant theme.
And I'm not, not tearing them down or building you up, but they'll get their stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
They're good. That it'll just happen in a different way.
Yeah, and it's not my place to, you know, feel bad or for them or anything like that, you know. But it is a weird thing that's like that confidence thing, which really is a good thing to have. It is a hard thing to hold on to because confidence can easily come off as cockiness, and that's something that I've never enjoyed.
I mean, I think you're right, but isn't that also allowing other people to judge your attitude for you?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, very much so. I should be paying you for this. I skipped therapy this week. This is great.
Are you okay with yourself on stage?
No, I always feel I could do better. I'm always every, even like after a really good set, I'll just be like, I'll be like, you know, I gotta push more. I always feel like I should be pushing a lot harder than I am. Yeah, even like after like a good set, I'll just
pushing
be like,
harder to make a to craft a funnier joke,
craft
to
a funnier
perform
joke,
perform it better, to
all of it,
all of it,
all of it. Yeah, it's
so you come off of your half hour special or one of your album releases, and you come off stage and think, I wish I
could have been better,
tried harder,
yeah,
been better and stuff.
Yeah,
as you work on, I suppose, your third album?
As I'm gearing up for another one, yeah. And it's like, that's the weird, but part about that is that, like, I say how, you know, I'm not, like, I was talking to Dave Anthony, and he was, for his album recording, he was going to have Patton open up, Patton Oswalt, and because they're buds, and, like, I was like, you're going to go on after Patton? He's like, yeah. I was like, but that's, no offense, but he's going to destroy the room, and then you're going to go up, and you're going to do great, but, like, it's Patton, you know, and these, just as, you know, these people are going to just go crazy for him, and then they're going to see you, and then he's like, yeah, but I'm funny, too. I go, no, you are. And he's like, what's the, like, it's a different act. Like, you know, he was very confused why I thought that, like, you know, you need to have someone a little less funny than you open up a show or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm a mess when it comes to that stuff.
Do you read a lot of comments online and everything?
I do my best not to.
Yeah.
Kathleen Hanna, who is in this band, Bikini Kill, and then on to La Tigre, she had this very awesome little article online where she said, well, does, and this has kind of been voided now that we found out that, you know, Beyonce's publicist reads her comments for her. But it's, does Beyonce read comments? Does Beyonce's too busy being fabulous to go look at YouTube comments of her performing. She doesn't care. She's too busy being Beyonce and, like, you know, going off and being this incredible person and doing this output and putting on these shows.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to change anything reading these comments. Yet, what I do if I ever come across one, you know, say sometimes you can't help but see a tweet that someone sends to you or accidentally see a comment. And if you see a bad one, what I normally do is I go to find a video of some comic I really like on YouTube, and then I just scroll through, or an album on iTunes, and then I press the search most critical, and then so I'll be looking at, like, Louis C.K. album with these people going, this guy sucks, and I go, oh, okay, there's just, not everybody's for everybody, you know, and it was that always makes me feel a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Do you?
I think I do, only because on my YouTube videos and a lot of my places or my Facebooks and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What can I say? I approve of comments.
Oh, okay.
Or disapprove of comments.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is maybe a mistake.
Because you still have to read them.
Yeah, because you have to read them in order to approve them or disapprove them. My opinion was always, hey man, I made this video. And I'll put on comments even that are critical, but I suppose because it's the Back to the Future thing, because I the pop iconography and stuff, I get a lot of kind of creepy, really, really negative comments.
Yeah,
really negative.
That have nothing
comments
to even do with the video.
Right, though. I could do anything. I could put up a Facebook, you know, of me helping poor children in Africa, and within 8 comments. Whatever. Well, I guess you should send them in a DeLorean to 88 miles an hour because you suck so bad. You know, and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
So my thing has always been, hey, man, hey, dude, hey, lonely dude in mommy's basement, you're not going to get to put that up anywhere, you know, with me on there.
Yeah.
Because good luck. I'm just not letting you. But it is a small thimble full of poison.
Yes, it's a little bit.
It's a tiny bit.
Yeah, and maybe when you take that daily, maybe eventually you become immune to that poison.
Maybe you do. I doubt human beings do.
Yeah.
I'm pretty immune to poison because I would, not getting all. Now I'll lay down on the psychiatrist's sofa. But I guess, you know, I was sick from school a lot. I was treated badly. So I got a lot of kind of negative feedback from kids at my school and everything. So later in that, after we talked about being big and everything, when I grew big, and I even talked about it on our Nerdist podcast that we did together, I got big very late and everything. But the thing was, I don't care what anybody says about anything, because people were so mean to me that it kind of, you know, it was that a nice punk molten lava inside there somewhere, which is like, no matter what anybody says, you can't get to me. But the fact is, you know, people still really can't get to me. But I suppose when you read a lot of those comments, you do think, wow, before the internet, I always thought that there was like a, you know, a creepy, weird, negative slice of pie in society.
Yeah.
But I guess this has really exposed that. I guess that slice of pie was much bigger than anyone had thought.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No one knew
the
demons that lurked behind.
Exactly. That there
I knew there were some ghosts, but all right. ghosts everywhere?
And all these dudes somewhere in greasy T-shirts in the basement. I don't know. There's a lot of... Just a lot of those guys.
Yeah, there's a thing everyone keeps on asking me, because like the podcast I started, Jonah Radio, like a lot of people keep on asking me, oh, what are the numbers like? And I tell them, oh, I don't know. They're like, well, do you check? I say, no. Why not? It's because it's not going to make a difference. It's right. It's like we have only 500 downloads an episode. Well, we better start, guys. Let's get this together. Right. Or it's like, well, we get 5,000 listeners an episode, guys. Let's keep it. You know, it's not going to make a difference
right.
to me, and that's like the one point of confidence I have with the stuff I do is that, you know, I'm just, and that's what's helped me actually. You know, that this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to do it the only way I know how. And if I try to do it another way, it's going to be disingenuous. And the only thing you could really do with any kind of art form is be genuine. And so, like, you know, that's the best thing you can do in any way.
I've been doing this for, I don't know, over a year now, a year and a half or something. I've never checked.
It's
so
best.
I really have no idea.
You like doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a good show. I listen to a bunch of them. I don't listen to a lot of podcasts, so.
Well, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, I like your intros a lot, too.
Oh, do you?
I love the free for me. Like, yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty free for me. See, a lot of commenters, that one goes right down the middle.
Yeah.
Of people like, wow, the freeform intros have got to go, man.
I
just
love
fast
it.
Forward. And then the people going like, I like the intro better than better than the conversation.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like every time they end, I was like, I want to, because it's almost so much fun to like how long can you really go? Because you really just like, you barely take a break and you just keep on pushing forward. It's like that thing where it's like, I got to get off my writer's block. You just keep writing. Don't stop.
Right. It is kind of that. Just I'll throw it out there and we'll get to, I'll say Jonah's name and then we'll start talking.
Yeah, yeah. And you find stuff in there when you're doing them. They're great.
Well, good. When did you start with, did you meet Chris Hardwick before the Nerdist thing?
Yeah. Yeah. I've known Chris since I started doing comedy. So
really?
Yeah. I've known Chris for 10 years.
Wow. So you were kind of stand-up friends?
Yeah. Stand-up friends, guys that just kind of knew each other. Sometimes him, I would play drums for him and Furman. If they were doing like being a house band at the M Bar for those old shows, Comedy Bang Bang, Death Ray shows. And you know, I remember, I was a kid drinking and Chris was a drinker at the time. So, you know, we would like sometimes go out drinking and stuff like that. He was always just a really nice guy. Then he got sober and we were just remained friends. And, I think we kind of got pretty close once where, I was going through a real bad breakup and I started getting like what I thought was like anxiety attacks or just, I was feeling weird about being out. And, I called him once and he like was sleeping, but woke up, took my phone call and like talked to me for a long time. That's when we started really become friends.
Uh-huh.
And, so we're both just doing stuff, you know, we're just friends that are just both doing comedy. And, I made a bunch of videos for a site called Super Deluxe that he really liked. He actually ended up showing them to like Weird Al once. And like, you know, he's like, Al really likes your videos. I was like, oh my God. He's like, they're really good, buddy. And I was like, oh, thanks. Your videos are good too. You know, just friends.
Sure.
Sharing stuff. And then, he got a pilot. He was the host of a pilot called Web Soup on G4. And then he's like, hey, you should come by the taping. So I went by the taping and it was great. We went and got food afterwards. I was like, hey, it's going to get picked up. It's great, man. And then it got picked up. And then he called me. He's like, it got picked up. I was like, oh, congrats, man. And he's like, I want you to work on it. And I was at a show called Rotten Tomato Show at Current TV, which was going to go for a while, at least a year. And we had just started the year and we were just going to go for at least a year. And I was miserable already. I was already miserable working at this place. And I'd been miserable at this company for a while. And like, I kind of like was still in this post breakup thing where I'm like, I'm just going to be a guy that works on shows no matter who knows them. I'm not really going to do stand up anymore. Just gonna be a guy that, you know, is funny.
Write a little comedy or sketch or something, kind of thing on TV shows.
Yeah, just write, produce on stuff, mm-hmm. you know, be background. And I was miserable. Like a thing that came around again because like the performance-y thing wasn't being fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris said, he's like, well, I want you to meet with the guys. I showed them your videos and like they really like you. The guys are running the Web Soup show. So going for a meeting. I was like, well, I'll go in for a meeting. I went in, I get along these showrunner guys. They're still some of my best friends. These guys are like two of the funniest guys. We get along right away. And they're like, we want to give you the job. And I was like, I don't know. I got to keep this straight job and get health insurance. Maybe that'll impress my ex-girlfriend enough to, you know, come back to me. Right. And then Chris like is like talking to me on the phone. He's like, you know, those jobs will be around forever. They're like, this kind of stuff will be a lot of fun and it will actually get you more exposure. And it was only for 8 weeks. It was like an eight episode order. And Chris, like, you know, really talked to me. He's like, if you don't do it, I understand, but I would really like you to do it. And then we did it. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life creatively to, like, leave that dull job and mm-hmm. do this esoteric, dumb sketches and jokes for that show.
Yeah.
And then we worked on a pilot for E! Called The Daily 10. It was a Daily 10 remake where Chris was the host. And I didn't get picked up. And if that thing got picked up, it would have changed Chris's life forever. And it didn't. And he kind of felt like, man. Oh, what do I do? He had all this energy of this thing that could have been. And then he decided, he's like, you know what? He called me. He's like, I want to start one of those podcast things. And I was like, yeah, that'd be fun. It's like we just talk, like a radio show, right? And he's like, yeah. And my friend will produce it. He'll be one of the hosts. It's this guy, Matt. He works at the App Store. I was like, cool. I met that guy. He's really funny. And then we just a few days later went and recorded it. And then it just like, it wasn't supposed to be this thing. I mean, it didn't set out to be a thing at all.
Right.
It was a thing we did with this nervous energy of just wanting to be funny and having a thing.
Yeah.
And it became like huge. And it's still hard for me to keep that perspective, the amount of people that listen to it. Because I really don't feel like it's my thing. It's like Chris has become this shining beacon. Like he's like rose up to the top as this guy. And I still feel like I'm just this, you know, this guy just doing stand up and kind of just happens to be on it sometimes. I don't feel like I'm a part of this monolith that is the Nerdist.
You don't feel that?
No, I don't, because it's Chris's thing. I'm there mm-hmm. and I'm being funny, but mm-hmm. I could sit back and relax and not talk for 20 minutes and no one will notice, yeah. You know, and I could just jump in with a joke.
I thought I talked too much because you and Matt didn't talk at all.
No, it's because you're very interesting and funny. We don't need to.
Because I went up to Chris at the end. I didn't want to, like, Joan and Matt didn't really talk very much. I was, you know.
And that happens. You know, I still have people that I know listen. They're like, it's like, they don't even really realize I'm a regular on the... They don't realize that the Nerdist is like the three of us.
Uh-huh.
Most people out there, most people that listen to it even, are very much a Nerdist is Chris Hardwick. And I didn't expect any of this stuff to happen. It's really weird. It kind of gave like a new, you know, now I have people that know me because of it.
Right.
It's crazy.
So now, I don't want to take up too much of your time.
I have nothing else to do for the rest of the day.
Really?
This is my favorite thing, because after this, we can go and do whatever we want.
Sounds like a five-parter.
but I have nothing to do except for avoid going to the gym.
Oh, well, we could work out together.
Yes, sir.
I don't know.
Just get on my back. I'll do a bunch of push-ups.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've done your 30-minute special.
No, a week from Thursday.
It's airing.
A week from Thursday, I'm taping it.
Oh, you're taping it?
Yeah.
Where are you taping it?
In Boston.
That'll be fun.
I think so.
I've always had fun in Boston shows.
Yeah, and I was able to like announce it, so I think a lot of the fans are going to be able to go to it and stuff like that.
That's a pretty good connection to have.
Yeah,
to actually promote the show on Nerdist Podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly.
7 trillion people listening. So, yeah, I'm putting this up soon. So where is it in Boston? What date?
It's February.
Can they can look you up.
Yeah, just go to jonahray.com, and then there's a link there to go to the taping.
So is this – have you cut out from your first two albums 30 minutes of your favorite stuff, or is this all kind of your contemporary thing that you're doing right now?
It's a mishmash of everything. There's there's a big chunks of new stuff connected by stuff from the last album, and then a couple – like a story, like maybe like half a joke from the first album uh-huh. and a story from the last album.
How are you happy with your albums?
As much as I can be, I think.
That's probably a good answer.
Yeah.
I think for anyone about an album.
Yeah. I mean, I don't if I enjoyed the first one as much as when I did it, that's not progress, you know? You should never like look at something you did years ago and go, I used to be so much better.
Yeah.
You know, you should be better. You should always be feel what you're doing at the moment is. And you know, sometimes that doesn't work. So sometimes bands get really bad. Mm-hmm. And they're doing stuff for this album now is our best album yet. You're like, right. No, the first one was the best.
So where do you travel around and do a lot of stand-up shows now, or are you doing less?
Well, I just got done working in November. I was at the Soup. I was writing on the Soup for about a year.
Uh-huh.
And I left that because I kind of wanted to write less magazine TV and get more into like narrative writing and acting and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And there it was really hard to, like, you know, you're in an office every day of the week. It's hard to get out. And because of those Bing commercials I did for Microsoft, I had the buffer to get out and, you know, just be an auditioning guy.
Right.
So I'm staying in town a lot now. And I think probably in the summertime, I'm going to end up going out and doing a bunch of shows. Uh-huh. I want to just middle for my friends. I want to just, like, you know, I'm just like telling, like, you know, I'm telling like Dana Gould and Bob Cadd and Chris. I'm like, it's like, you know, this summer, let me middle for you.
Right. Right.
I love a middle spot. It's so fun.
I have so many people who listen to my podcast who want to get in to the business, or young people who really long to do that. So can I just ask, at the very beginning, the inception of being out here and starting to write for television, was that all based on guys you had met in shows and open mics and the stand-up comedy community?
Oh, it's completely that. It's, you know, half of doing comedy is being social. It's hanging out after the show. It's talking comedy with people, and it's being pleasant to be around. That's a big part of it, you know, because they're going to want to hang out with you in a room. You know, they're going to want to help you out if you're nice and you're funny. And it's, you know, it's the way I got into writing is just, it's so, it feels happenstance. That's how I feel about everything. But you know, like, I got a job as a writer's assistant on a on the Andy Milonakis show on MTV. How I got it was this guy I was running it, John Kimmel, Jimmy's brother. I would just run into him at parties, and I'd be funny and fun, and like, he's like, "Hey, you're really funny. Would you want to be the writer's assistant? And you can also like submit, you know, sketches too." Like, that was just, that's how it happened.
Right.
It's this guy that liked talking to me.
Right.
And helped me out. And then I got that, and, you know, just doing open mics and talking with like guys like Scott Aukerman, BJ Porter. I got to write on a pilot they did years and years ago, produced by Dan Pasternak, who's now at IFC. Who now, you know, it's like everyone you meet and talk to becomes something else, you know, someone that can help you. And it's, you know, it sounds like an LA thing, you know, that like, it's like, it's who you know, but there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, it is who you know, but it's who you've also impressed with your humor, talent, professionalism, and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not who you, I mean, you can know a lot of people and not be very good.
That's true. Yeah, it's, you know, it's just, it really comes down to be as funny as you can, or be so like true to yourself, but like don't poo away being a good person
because
of that. Don't like focus so much on a career and you know, your idea of what a comedian is, so it gets in the way of personal relationships, because whatever happens in your career, in the end, you're only going to have your friends and your loved ones like with you. That's the thing that, like, you know, I turned 30 last year, and a lot of it was like, you know, this is going to just keep on going. Like, you know, when you're young, you have this idea of like, I got to get this thing, and then I'm going to be this guy. And then you forget to build yourself as a person, as a real full whole person. And you need to remember that. You need to keep that in mind, because then, like, you know, say you get a job and you feel comfortable with your career, you're going to just all of a sudden, you're going to be a child when you start trying to date somebody. I have a friend who was like so set on just like getting a show, getting, like, he was a writer, wanted to make a cartoon. He like basically kind of like disappeared for like, and just like holed up in his house, like, you know, just like, you know, his apartment. And, you know, never really talked to anybody. And finally he got a show, and like, now it's like hanging out with him is like different, because he might've developed his comedic voice. He might've developed his writing to be able to sell the show to Fox that's going to get made. But now he's weird. He doesn't know how to interact with people. And that's you know, interacting with people, like, it's like, that's life. Everything else is just fun. Everything else is just comedy. It's like, you know, it's silly. It's entertainment. It's a hobby that gives you money. But like, it's like what I wish someone would have told me is, it's like, hey, pay attention to being a person.
But you've always been a person, Jonah. I mean, you're a very popular guy personally.
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, you're a gentleman and you're friendly and you're professional.
Go fuck
yourself.
Good.
What? What? Hey, wait a minute. Come right across this table. I don't want to, you know, again, I don't want to keep you here long, and so we won't go through the inception of the Meltdown show, but there is a pilot, and it's going to be a TV show.
Well, let's hope it'll be a TV show.
Well, it's a pilot.
Yeah, it's a pilot.
It's a pilot for Comedy Central?
For Comedy Central,
okay.
Kamel and I hosting.
Because I've talked about the Meltdown show numerous times on the podcast, and what a great time I've had.
Thanks.
And telling people, if they're in L.A. on a Wednesday night, it's the show to see.
It's so much fun. It's, you know, it's just another thing where I feel so lucky to have that be a thing. Like, it's a blast every week. It's like I get to do it with like some of my best friends, just like Kumail, Emily, and Ed. Like these are like friends I hang out with anyway.
Yeah.
And we get to put on the show that everyone like we pack the room.
It's packed.
Yeah, it's packed.
But it's packed. It's packed in a different way, Jonah. That the audience who comes to your show, the Meltdown show, it really does remind me of I think my earliest days on stage before. The audience was just expecting the guy in front of the brick wall.
Yeah.
You know, the evening at the improv and many of those things, not that they weren't great shows, they were all great.
Yeah.
But it groomed the audience into expecting a thing that they would see. And then everyone had to start almost molding for the audience because they were going, well, that's not that thing that I saw at 11:30 at night when I watched that thing.
Exactly.
And previous to that, it was audience going, I'm not sure what I'm going to see.
Yeah, they had no idea what the concept of stand-up was.
I'm not sure who's really in this or what, but it's something and it's happening. I mean, it's a hotbed of creativity. And I'm just going with an open mind to see what these people have to offer. And that's the Meltdown show.
Yeah.
Is I think you're introduced and you come out and the entire audience, these kind of open, friendly faces.
Yeah.
Of going like, well, what do you have to offer?
And that's how I feel about the show exactly, is that, you know, I've talked to people, audience people that just come every week, and I go, well, what do you – because I notice people will cheer equally for a name or like someone they don't know. It just sounds the same when we announce them and they come out. And I was asking some people, I was like, why do you guys get just as excited? They're like, well, if it's someone we know, awesome. Love this guy. Can't wait to see him again. If it's someone we don't know – well, they got to be good. And we get excited because it's like another new person I'm going to like because they know that the show is like curated with care.
Right.
And that's what I love it because, like, you know, and I'm sure one day, years down the road, it'll get to a place where everyone's always expecting, you know, as like, you know, the people we have on the show become big stars, like Pete Holmes and Aziz and, you know, these people kind of getting bigger and bigger. They're going to expect those people to show up and they're going to kind of get jaded. And that's what happens. Nothing ever lasts forever, you know. So it's like there's always a lifespan to these shows.
I will always show up. Like Tony Randall, the actor on The Tonight Show. They would always go to him. You know, if whoever. Harrison Ford cancels, you go to Tony Randall.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm always willing to be the Meltdown Show's Tony Randall.
That is great. That's right. You know who else said the same thing? It was Bobcat. Oh, okay, yeah. He's like, hey, if anyone cancels, I'll just drive over the hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great show.
Yeah, you are always welcome.
Oh, thanks, buddy. Yeah. What's the pilot about? I mean, is it just the stand-up performances?
It's a stand-up showcase show, but we did it like we've seen these other shows that try to like capture, they do like a fake version, like, you know, a mutated version of what they think that show is supposed to be like. What we want to do is just instead of like a, you know, people going to a TV taping, we want like the TV taping to come to the people. We made a documentary of the night, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. We shot the crap out of like, you know, the comics and stuff like that, but we also shot people backstage hanging out. Everybody that was backstage was loved, you know, they had microphones on them. And so it caught like the comics backstage joking around, people eating, grabbing a drink, you know, had all that stuff. And, you know, the comics that did it all, you know, killed, and the audience was great. And it's so it's real loose. It's like a documentary, but still, like, it shows, you know, something closer to what stand-up's been like the past 10 years, which is unconventional venues, you know, just, like, not alternative, but because, like, alternative puts a weird connotation on the kind of comedy it is. It's funny comedy. It's still good comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had Jim Gaffigan, Tom Lennon, you know, young guys like Gerard Carmichael. And you know, Pete Holmes, Nick Kroll, like, you know, all this kind of mishmash of different types of people. And it's just, it's like, it's, if anything, it's going to be a great document of what we've been doing for the show. And if it gets picked up, it'll be like a great way to show people that comedy doesn't have to be, you know, stuffy. It doesn't have to be at a club. It doesn't have to, you know, comedy. You can put comedy anywhere. That's the thing. Like, you know, that's what's happening around the country, is that kids are saying, hey, this bar, this coffee shop, or this record store, or this, you know, arcade has a corner with a little riser. Let's put on a comedy show here.
Mm-hmm.
Comedy doesn't have to exist anywhere. As long as it's funny, it's going to be a
I think
show.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely fantastic because, yeah. I had heard about the show, of course, and then my manager called, hey, they do this show, and it's the back of a comic book store. It's really? The back of a comic? Okay. I haven't done a gig in the back of a comic book store before. And, yeah. You know, so my wife is used to me coming home. And how did the show go? Oh, fine. You know,
yeah.
It was fine. It was a show. It was fine. It was good. And I came back going, that thing was unbelievable. It was just great, man.
Yeah.
The audience is fantastic.
Yeah.
Everyone is great. Anyway, I always rave about it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was years, you know, years to get it going. And I was... Linda Pine started the show as a monthly show. I took it over from her, was doing it monthly for a long time, wanted to take it weekly, didn't have the time or energy.
Mm-hmm,
you know, weekly
sure.
show is a lot to do, you know. Then you become that guy that's like, oh, is this guy booking me because he wants to be on my show?
Right,
you know?
Right.
But Emily and Kumail moved to town. They wanted to start a weekly show. I said, well, we're all friends. Why don't you just, me and Kumail will host it? And then it just kind of like the monthly audience immediately just picked up and started coming every week.
Mm.
And then just grew from there.
Yeah. So let me let you go from this, because I don't, you know, I don't,
you don't
want to
take up too much of my time. I'm such a busy guy.
Well, you have a lot of things. I mean, you have, how many web presences do you have? I mean, well, you have your own, you have Jonah Radio.
I have Jonah Radio.
Which is based, it seems to me, unless I'm wrong, based musically. A lot of music.
Yeah, we play songs. Like we have bands send us their stuff. And I kind of pick the ones I really like, and we play them and tell people where to go to get their stuff. And some bands have been saying, like, we've seen an uptick in our sales, or people came to our show, said they heard us on your podcast.
That's great.
Yeah, it's, you know, when it's always nice to get to a place, and I'm not saying like I'm at any kind of place, but like, you know, people tend to sometimes pay attention to me, and thankfully those people, you know, will go and listen to those bands or mm-hmm. support more independent artists.
So Jonah Radio, you're on the Nerdist.
I'm on the Nerdist
podcast.
Yeah, more often than not.
More often than not.
Yeah.
What else are you doing? You have a very active Tumblr.
I have a Tumblr. That's fun. That's just fun because I like Tumblr, because essentially it's like, look at this cool thing I found, or look at this cool thing I made.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's really like putting your hands in a rushing river and just coming up with shiny stuff.
Yeah.
Look at this, a fish.
Yeah, yeah.
Look and at this, I found a boot.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just stuff just going.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's what I'm doing right now is just trying to, now that I'm like away from the soup and the kind of 9-to-5 gigs I was doing. Like, I'm working with a really awesome director named Danny Jelinek. We're going to like be doing some stuff for Funny or Die.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it's like, I never, of any of the stuff I do, I never think about like, what are people going to notice it? I think about like, well, I got all this stuff I'm doing. I got to put it somewhere. You know, it's
so
like,
you just
if you
put it out there.
Yeah. You know, if like, you know, if I'm making pots, or, you know, I'm a pottery person, you know, I'm going to put them on the shelf. But if I'm going to make these like shorts, I'm going to make these jokes and these things, I'm going to put them on the digital shelf.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if people come by, they come by.
And it is, I mean, I guess as a guy who came before the internet, it's still a great thing that you can do whatever. You can write a song, or you can make a short thing.
Yeah.
You could do a sketch. You could do a comedy show. And you could just put it out there.
Just put it
and
out.
And people could see it from Morocco.
Yeah. It's great.
It is really fantastic.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Like, it really, it put the power back into, like, that's like, you know, the thing I've always, you know, like with bringing it back to like punk stuff. It's, you know, you didn't have to really learn or know how to play instruments really well to be in a band. You made it work with what you have. And I, even like that, like, transfers over into everything I make. Like, you know, I'm like my comedy and the videos I make and stuff like that. Like, you know, sometimes like I don't know how to do it, so it's going to be the best thing in the world, but it's the best thing that I'm able to do. And sometimes, you know, maybe I'm a lo-fi comedian, you know? And I'll like, it's like, I'm not shooting for the stars. I'm shooting for just what's going to make me feel good about
yeah.
the stuff I make.
As a guy so connected with the culture, with the, you know, with podcasts, with this huge Nerdist empire as you are, mm-hmm. what do you see something else happening in the next 10 years or 20 years that performers will be doing? Are there inklings of something that people don't know about?
Like a style or a
way to get to the audience.
Oh,
a style and anything.
Yeah, it really is going to, like, podcasting is really, I think that's going to stick around for a lot longer.
You think it's going to be
because more and more people keep on doing it. And it's I really do believe that that as much as internet stuff is a global thing, what it really is doing is helping local scenes. I think comedy and entertainment is going to get real regional in the next, like, you know, it's like there's going to be shows and comics and scenes and videos and, like, whole scenes just like in Albuquerque.
You're right, because it's happening now.
Yeah.
It's happening now, which is great. I mean, you go, the traveling comedian, I go to Portland or I go to wherever. You could go anywhere. And there's just there's a hotbed of people just doing stuff and putting it on the internet or doing their own podcast or doing their things, supporting each other.
I think it's people jumping for these, like, global, international, you know, or just, you know, in national fame of doing comedy. And, like, they're reaching for it, but what they're doing is they're just creating this local scene. And that's in this local scenes are what really is going to just drive, like, you know, future entertainment, I believe. You know, it's going to be like people, like, in, like, you know, these guys, Grolix, this, like, little comedy team, Adam Caton Holland is in Denver. Like, they have this, like, packed show, and they just made a deal with Amazon to do these, like, you know, shorts or like a series or something like that. But they're going to do it all out of Denver because they're going to stay there, support the scene. They're going to put local guys on the as actors on the show, and blah blah blah. It's like, you know, it's going to be basically just get back to being like punk, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, I think can't be more excited about that.
I think it's just great.
Yeah,
it's just great. Thanks so much.
No, thank you.
I really appreciate your time.
It's an honor to be on your show.
Thanks very much.
I'll mention it on the Nerd.
Would you?
Yeah, maybe. Thanks. We'll see if I get to it. We'll see if Chris doesn't cut it out.
Well, I guess as you can hear from our conversation, Jonah and I are kindred spirits, I think. And after meeting him, he made such an impression on me as a nice guy and a creative artist and a person that I wanted to have on my podcast. Although he's on a lot of podcasts, I really appreciate his time. Thanks so much, Jonah. And thank you. Thank you for dropping by. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, Jonah, everyone over at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to Chris and Guitars for helping me out. Live show. Come out and see a live show. I'm in Hartford, Connecticut. When? Next week. Next Wednesday through Sunday. So if you're listening to this on time, come to the Hartford Funny Bone out there and we're having fun. And hey, thanks so much for listening. Tell a friend. Consider subscribing. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.